Okay, Dennis, greetings very much. Okay, good. Well, welcome back, everybody, to the Lincoln Chorus. And I guess we can talk more about the Fed later, if anybody wants to. And but Lincoln's Big Lie is the topic for the evening. And it starts with some historical perspective in that there always has been in America the battle, political battle between from the very beginning, the centralizers or the nationalists versus the Jeffersonians who advocated decentralized government and more limited government. And the story really begins with Hamilton, who lobbied for 7 years for the Constitutional Convention, which overthrew the Articles of Confederation rather than revising them as was promised. And Hamilton's plan at the convention was to have a permanent president who would appoint all the governors, who would in turn have veto power over all state legislation. And of course, he and his comrades failed at that, and then but they never gave up. And so once they failed, one of the first things they did was to begin reinventing history, rewriting history to make their case that that we should have a powerful, monopolistic, central government. And Hamilton himself did this in a public speech before the New York State Assembly on June 29th, 1787, where he said, quote, "The states were merely artificial beings," end quote, "and were never sovereign." He said the nation and not the states was sovereign. And this, as far as I know, was the first rendition of this, the Lincoln Big Lie, that the states were never sovereign. And the people must have been mystified and wondering, what on earth is he talking about? And so he had a lot of help. He had a lot of help with this. His fellow nationalist, John Marshall, who was the Chief Justice of the United States from 1801 until the mid-1830s, was slavishly devoted to Hamilton and Hamilton's statist ideas, and especially the whole idea of a powerful central government where the states and the people of the states would essentially have almost no role at all. And so in some of his more famous court cases, Marshall almost verbatim repeated Hamilton's line that the states were never sovereign. For example, here's one thing Marshall said. He said, "In the name of the people, the federal government claims the right to legitimately control all individuals or governments within the American territory. All individuals and all governments, the federal government claims the ability and the power to control them." Now, of course, the only way they could do that is through force and coercion and violence, and which, of course, they did during the Civil War. But this was never a part of the founding generation's ideas. What Marshall is probably alluding to is how he and his compatriots, his fellow nationalists, also perverted the meaning of the so-called Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which only said that in those things that are listed in Article 1, Section 8, the so-called delegated powers, the federal government is supreme there. That is, the state of West Virginia cannot have its own foreign policy, for example. That's the power of the federal government. And, you know, calling the militia, raising armies, and so forth, those are federal prerogatives. But then under the 10th Amendment, everything else is reserved to the people and the states, respectively. But the nationalists have always made this argument, try to sneak this argument in, that the so-called Supremacy Clause means the federal government is supreme over everything and everyone. And that is exactly what John Marshall said. He said the government, the federal government, claims the right to legitimately control all individuals or governments within the American territory. And so these people were busy lying about history in the very beginning, just like the Soviets, when they took over, rewrote Russian history to solidify their power. Another prominent participant in this is the Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story, who wrote a famous book, Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States, and it was considered to be the book about the Constitution by the nationalists who were mostly New Englanders in the 19th century. And he repeated the same song. At one point he says this about the Constitution. He says, it was established by the people of the United States, not the distinct people of a particular state, but the people of the other states, end quote. Nothing in the world could be further from the truth. As Article 7 explains, Article 7 of the Constitution, it was the people of the states, not state legislatures, the people of the states who appointed representatives to state political conventions who ratified the Constitution. There was no whole people involved. There was no national plebiscite ever over this. This is just a lie, but it's Joseph Story's line. Daniel Webster was another prominent nationalist who repeated the same thing. He said this in a famous debate he had with Robert Hayne, the senator from South Carolina, over the nature of the Constitution. This was in the early 1830s. He said that the Constitution of the United States confers on the government itself the power of deciding ultimately and conclusively upon the extent of its own authority. Really, so the founding fathers said that the government itself should be the sole arbiter of the limits of its own power. False again, that never happened. The Virginia Senator John Taylor said this about it. He said, the Constitution never could have designed to destroy liberty by investing in 5 or 6 men installed for life with the power of regulating the constitutional rights of all political departments. He certainly was right about that. And so these men, these very prominent men, were making the case for monopolistic centralized government, and they were claiming that that's what actually happened at the Constitutional Convention. In other words, they were claiming that Hamilton's dream, which was rejected thoroughly by the convention attendees, was not rejected. It was accepted after all. And I guess by the 1830s, they counted on the notion that most Americans had forgotten about what happened and the Constitutional Convention, and of course, it was all a secret. It was all kept a secret, but the word did get out by the 1820s from James Madison's notes and from the notes taken by Robert Yates, the Chief Justice of New York, who was an attendee of the Constitutional Convention, and so Americans did know about this. And so, in my opinion, these men were just flat out lying for the sake of promoting a big nationalized government, centralized government. Yes. Erica says she read part of that debate for Tom Wood's nullification class. I have a short article about it on lewrockwell.com entitled The Founding Fathers of Constitutional Subversion. And then I expanded that. It's going to be a chapter of a book that Donald Livingston is editing. It's going to be published in another month or so. But the short web version is on lewrockwell.com. And so that's where this idea starts. It starts in this attempt to subvert constitutional limitations on government. And of course, by the time you get to Lincoln's day, he just repeats it. It wasn't new to him at all. And so as far as state sovereignty is concerned, I think it's important to understand that all the founding documents, the Articles of Confederation, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, all use the words the states are. Whenever the states are mentioned, it's used in the plural, the states are. And that's important because if the United States is, that's a monolithic entity. United States are means individual sovereign states are participating in creating a union of states for their benefit, for example. The name of the article was The Founding Fathers of Constitutional Subversion. Somebody on the chat is asking about the title. And so if you look at all of these documents, they all recognize that the states were sovereign, especially the Declaration of Independence. If you read the Declaration of Independence, it says very clearly there that the states are free and independent. Those are the exact words. In fact, yeah, here's what it says. I have it in front of me. This is a part of near the end of the Declaration of Independence. is that these United Colonies are and are right ought to be free and independent states. And in the Declaration of Independence, the words free and independent states are in capital letters. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and do all other things which independent states may of right do. And that is another reason, you know, if you read that, it's another reason why Lincoln really perverted the Declaration of Independence. He turned it into an anti-secession document when he quoted the all men are created equal part. And of course, from our previous class, we know Lincoln certainly did not believe that all men are created equal, but he used that rhetoric. But he used that rhetoric to turn this secessionist document, a declaration of secession from the British Empire, into an anti-secession document by a sort of a sleight of hand. But clearly, Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote the Declaration, like all the other founders, thought of the states as free and independent states, just like England was a free and independent state, or France or Spain. So Virginia and Massachusetts and Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, they were all free and independent states in that sense. And in Article 7, of course, of the Constitution, Article 7 of the Constitution says that the Constitution will be ratified by the people of the states, 9 of the 13 states. And another subterfuge that Webster was known for is the preamble of the Constitution. And so was Story. Story told this story also. And so, you know, the preamble talks about, you know, we the people. And so when Joseph Story and Daniel Webster talk about this, they use that. They say, well, the founders obviously meant the whole people of the United States because they said we the people. But James Madison's notes on the debates of the Federal Convention proves that this is wrong, because the first draft of the document of the Constitution read this as follows: we the people of the states of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island and Providence plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina and Georgia, do ordain, declare and establish the following Constitution for the government of ourselves and our posterity. And so, but then they realized, well, wait a minute, we don't know that all 13 colonies will ratify this Constitution. And so we really can't name all these states because, you know, this is they're writing the Constitution, and then it went to the states for ratification. And so they said, well, let's just leave it as we the people and not name all the individual states. But it was assumed, of course, that it meant all the individual states because that's how it was ratified. So that's another sort of sleight of hand that's been used by the nationalists to try to make the case that the federal government in Washington should be all powerful over all individuals and all governments, as John Marshall said. But it's all a lie. The Treaty of Great Britain that ended the Revolutionary War. Here's what the King of Great Britain said. Article 1 of the Treaty with Great Britain says this: His Britannic Majesty acknowledges the said United States, these New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island and Providence plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia to be free, sovereign, and independent states, that he treats them as such and for himself, his heirs and successors. He relinquishes all claims to the government, proprietary, and territorial rights of the same and every part thereof. So the treaty ending the Revolutionary War was not a treaty with something called the United States government. It was a treaty with all the individual states named separately in the peace treaty. And so that's further evidence that the business about the whole people or the whole nation creating the Constitution is really nonsense. Of course, there's the famous Tocqueville. Even a lot of the Lincoln cultists, as I call them, are keen on quoting Tocqueville when it suits them. But something that they never quote is this. In his famous book, Democracy in America, Alexis de Tocqueville wrote about how the American Constitution was adopted and how it works. And he said this, the Union was formed by the voluntary agreement of the states, and in uniting together, they have not forfeited their nationality, nor have they been reduced to the condition of one and the same people. If one of the states chooses to withdraw from the compact, it would be difficult to disprove its right of doing so, and the federal government would have no means of maintaining its claims directly, either by force or right. And of course, the eventually did. Here's what even Hamilton voiced that view, that the federal government would have no rights to invade a sovereign state. He wrote this, I'll quote Alexander Hamilton, Federalist Papers, number 81. It said, the Constitution confers no right of action independent of the sovereign will. To authorize suits, means lawsuits, against states for the debts they owe could not be done without waging war against the contracting state, a power which would involve such a consequence it would altogether be forced and unwarranted. So the use of force for any reason to collect debts or anything like that would be unwarranted, even according to Alexander Hamilton. And then you have Thomas Jefferson. I think I might have mentioned this before, but it really is remarkable to compare Jefferson's views on the nature of the Union, the voluntary nature of the Union, with Lincoln's, who of course thought it was worth the death of 670,000 Americans to save the Union geographically. But here's what Jefferson said in his first inaugural address. If there be any among us who would wish to dissolve this Union or to change its Republican form, let them stand undisturbed as the monuments of the safety with which error of opinion may be tolerated where reason is left to combat it. And he said that at a time when the New England Federalists were talking about and even plotting to secede from the Union. And so here's President Thomas Jefferson, knowing that the New Englanders were seriously considering seceding because they hated Jefferson and his party so much. And he says this, he doesn't say, he doesn't threaten force, invasion, bloodshed like Lincoln did. He said that. And then later on, in a January 29th, 1804 letter to a Dr. Joseph Priestley, Jefferson, who was on this subject, Jefferson said, whether we remain one Confederacy or form into the Atlantic and Mississippi Confederacies, I believe not very important to the happiness of either part. Those of the Western Confederacy will be as much our children and descendants as those of the Eastern, and I feel myself as much identified with that country in future time as with this one. And did I now foresee a separation, that is, secession, at some future day, yet I should feel the duty and the desire to promote the Western interests as zealously as the Eastern, doing all the good for both portions of our future family, which should fall within my power. So he called. So he said, if there was a breakup of the Union into separate confederacies, these would be our children and our family. They would all be Americans, and they would have differences in economic opinions and cultural differences, and that's fine if they want to separate. God bless them, was Jefferson's opinion. It wasn't, you will die by the hundreds of thousands, and we will bomb your cities and burn them to the ground. That would have been thought to be just the most barbaric act in the history of the world up to that point, to do such a thing. And so that was Jefferson's basic idea about secession. And he held that position until the day he died. There were other letters from Jefferson in the early 1820s, shortly before his death, where he expressed the same sentiments. And also, of course, in my readings, in the readings I put on the reading list, especially my book chapter from The Real Lincoln, I noted that Virginia, New York, and Rhode Island, as a condition of ratifying the Constitution, they reserve the right of all states, not just their states, but of all states, to resume the powers that they had delegated to the central government, if in the future that government became abusive of their liberties. And they were accepted into the Union with that provision, And under the Constitution, no state has more rights than any other state. So when they were accepted into the Union, it was agreed that all states would have that right, because you can't have the situation where just Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York have the right to leave the Union in the future date. They all did. And also the future states. The way it works is that states beyond the original 13 that enter the Union enter with all the same rights and privileges and so forth that the original 13 had. It all applies equally. The central government did not create those states either. The people of those territories did. And I hope you had a chance to read about the New England secessionists. They were very upset with Jefferson because they fundamentally disagreed with his philosophy. They were the nationalists. Jefferson was the decentralist. And also the Louisiana Purchase enraged the New Englanders. They thought that the hordes of foreigners that would occupy the territory of the Louisiana Purchase would despoil the purity of the New England stock that they believed they were a part of, and would dilute it so much that they would not even want to be a part of any such country with all those dirty Germans and Italians and Spaniards occupying, and French occupying those places. And so they believed they were God's chosen people, and that the Louisiana Purchase would ruin all of that. And so they talked about secession, and the leader of the secession movement in New England was Senator Timothy Pickering, who was the United States Senator from Massachusetts. He was also George Washington's adjutant general during the Revolutionary War. And then he served as Secretary of State and Secretary of War under President George Washington. So this was not some nut from out of nowhere. This was a very prominent founding father. And some of the other very prominent Revolutionary War heroes and founding fathers, really ought to be called the founding generation, not founding fathers, were a part of the New England secession movement, which culminated in the Hartford, Connecticut Secession Convention of 1814, where they eventually decided not to secede. But at the same time, there was little discussion, little opposition to the idea of secession on philosophical grounds. Just about everyone agreed that they had a right if they wanted to, because the Union was voluntary. And so that was the read about the New England secession movement, if you will. A lot of New England abolitionists also advocated secession because they didn't want to have to enforce the fugitive slave clause. And so nobody was threatening to bomb Boston, Massachusetts, and burn it to the ground at the time. And I also mentioned in my writings that there's a book by a William C. Wright, spelled W-R-I-G-H-T, so Wright, it's called The Secession Movement in the Middle States. It's about the Middle Atlantic states in the 1850s, where there was a secession movement also. And of course, I also cite a book called Northern Editorials on Secession, big fat two-volume set of books, that makes the case that the majority of Northern editorial writers were in favor of peaceful secession. They quoted Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence saying that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, and whenever the people of the state no longer consent to be governed for whatever reason, they have a right to leave. They don't need the permission of the other states. If you need the permission of other states, then you really don't have the right of secession. And I think it's important also to keep in mind that the founding fathers like Jefferson, who supported secession, they understood fully that secession and nullification would not happen very often, but their mere existence as a right would be very useful in disciplining the government, because if the government overstepped its bounds, its constitutional bounds too severely, it would always know that states could reserve the right to nullify federal laws or to secede if they needed to, if it got oppressive enough. And so they didn't expect that this would happen very often, nullification or secession, but the acknowledgement that people possess those rights was thought to discipline the government and keep the constitutional contract together. And it did a reasonable job of that until Lincoln came around. Okay, so I would read that. I would read that my writings on the Middle Atlantic secession movement and the New England secession. Americans don't know about this. And most Americans don't know very much at all about this whole area of Lincoln and Civil War. And by the way, since I'm advertising that I'm going to be at Ron Paul's Fed hearing tomorrow morning, on July 17th, I'm going to be on Freedom Watch with Judge Napolitano, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the Fox Business Network. And it's a President's Day show. And of course, he has me on there to talk about Lincoln, but Walter Williams will be there. And several other guests will be on the show. We're going to talk about Lincoln, Jefferson, FDR, Woodrow Wilson, John F. Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan in the show. And it should be fun. He has five or six libertarians rounded up, including the judge himself. So that should be fun. Walter Williams is a nationally syndicated columnist. He wrote the foreword to my book, The Real Lincoln. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University. A very well-known nationally syndicated columnist. Okay, so another aspect of this about Lincoln's big lie that the states were never sovereign is if you look at in my book, The Real Lincoln, on page 116, I quote the legal scholar James Ostrowski, who put forth a very clever argument of what, when Lincoln said that the states were not sovereign, we asked, well, what does that mean about Lincoln's theory of the Constitution, how the Constitution was formed? And so here's what Lincoln is assuming. If he or anyone else assumes that the states do not have a right to secede, he's assuming that the founding fathers in the founding generation that ratified the Constitution believed in the following things. No state may ever secede from the Union for any reason. If any state attempts to secede, a federal government shall invade such a state with sufficient military force to suppress the secession. The federal government may require all states to raise militias to be used to suppress the seceding states. After suppressing the secession, the federal government may rule by martial law until such time as the state accepts permanent federal supremacy. And then after the secession is suppressed, the federal government may force the states to adopt new constitutions imposed on them by the federal military authorities, which is what happened during Reconstruction. And finally, the president may, on his own authority and without consulting any branch of government, suspend the Bill of Rights and the writ of habeas corpus. And of course, that's what Lincoln did. And so Ostrowski makes the obvious point that there never would have been a constitution. If this was the understanding of what the states were entering into with the constitutional compact, there would have been not one state that ratified the Constitution. And so, and that really pinpoints, I think, what a radical rewriting of the Constitution and American history the Lincoln regime was based on, because this was ultimately the assumption that they made when they did that. And the Constitution was barely ratified as it was. The votes in a lot of the states were very narrow. And Rhode Island and North Carolina took over a year after the Constitution was in place to just finally decide to join the Union, as far as that goes. So that's yet another point that I think is pretty important. It really highlights what I consider to be the ridiculous nature of Lincoln's argument that the states were never sovereign. And of course, I put my article entitled Jaffa's Hitlerian Defense of Lincoln on the reading list because it's kind of funny that I was in a debate with this guy, and as he has done through his whole career, he has used ad hominem comments, and he's about 100 years old now. But his whole life he used ad hominem comments to debate his debating partners with, such as sleazy references that they probably would agree with Adolf Hitler or something like that. And of course, I turned the tables on him and proved that Hitler was a centralizer just like him and just like Lincoln. And Adolf Hitler literally referred to Lincoln's argument in Lincoln's first inaugural address, to make his argument, make Hitler's argument for abolishing states' rights or federalism altogether in Germany. And so if you read that article, you'll find Hitler himself paraphrasing Abe Lincoln's first inaugural address, claiming that the states were never sovereign, that the Union created the states somehow. But if you think about that, it is not only is it historically untrue, but it's logic, it's illogical. It's illogical for the union of two things to be older than the things themselves. That would be like saying a marital union can be older than either spouse in a union, which is literally impossible to occur. And so if you don't really think about that, even just listen to the rhetoric and how it sounds, I guess you can fall for this, as quite a few people have. But it makes no sense logically or historically that this is the way it was. And of course, there's a long history of understanding of this, that centralized governmental power is very, very dangerous. I might as well read one of my favorite quotes about this is from Ludwig von Mises, his book Omnipotent Government, where he wrote about, he's talking about the protests against big government in his time, okay, during his time. So what are they protesting about? And here's what Mises wrote. He says, new powers accrued not to the member states, but to the federal government. That's what people are really angry about. Not that the state governments are saintly, or not that they're not corrupt just like the federal government, but at least you have some diversity there with the states, and you might have an escape route to a less oppressive state if you have somewhere else to go other than the central government. He goes on to continue with von Mises, every step toward more government interference and more planning means at the same time an expansion of the jurisdiction of the central government. Washington and Bern, Switzerland, the capital of Switzerland, were once the seats of the federal governments. Today they are the capitals in the true sense of the word, and the states and cantons are virtually reduced to the status of provinces. It is a very significant fact that the adversaries of the trend toward more government control describe their opposition as a fight against Washington and a fight against Bern, i.e. against centralization. It is conceived as a contest of states' rights versus the central power, end quote. So that's Ludwig von Mises saying in his book, Omnipotent Government, that the whole argument over and against centralized government, big government, is really the argument over centralized versus decentralized government, because he's not taking that into consideration sort of the anarchist argument, but he's saying in the world today, there are some anarchists out there, but for the most part, it's people who think a government should be limited and decentralized as much as possible versus the advocates of highly centralized government. That's where the argument is. And of course, there's a long history of that. I also, in some of my writings, have quoted Felix Morley. There's a great book on federalism or states' rights, whatever you want to call it. If I were to recommend, I can think of two books that are really excellent. One is Freedom and Federalism by Felix Morley, M-O-R-L-E-Y. And the other one is The Sovereign States by James J. Kilpatrick. James J. Kilpatrick was a columnist, syndicated columnist for many, many years. I think he's still around, but he's retired. And he was a great writer, and a very learned man. And he wrote this book quite a long time ago, The Sovereign States. And it's really a fine piece of scholarship for journalists, as far as that goes. But in another book that touches upon this and makes some very good points is Frank Chodorov, C-H-O-D-O-R-O-V. And the book is The Income Tax, Root of All Evil. He talks about the centralizing effects of the income tax and how evil it has been, and how useful a tool it has been to consolidate political power in the central government, because they can bribe just about everybody. The government, when it's armed with the income tax, it can bribe individuals who are the recipients of grants and other largesse. It can bribe corporations. It can threaten corporations who are on the dole, and so forth. And so it wasn't just that the government grabbed a lot of our money. It really led to a tremendous centralization of political power when the income tax was adopted in 1913, same year that the Fed was adopted, as far as that goes. I mentioned in my writing, some of which I put on the reading list, that some of the worst tyrants in world history, such as Adolf Hitler, were advocates of centralized government. Everybody knows that. And also in The Real Lincoln, near the end, there's a famous quote, famous to, among those of us who study these issues anyway, by Lord Acton, where Lord Acton was the British historian of liberty. He wrote many big books about the history of liberty. He was an advisor to the Prime Minister of England during Queen Victoria's time. And he was writing, and he was professionally active during the American Civil War and for years thereafter. And after the war, he wrote a letter to Robert E. Lee. In fact, he corresponded with Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general, several times during and after the war. And on November 4th, 1866, he wrote this to Lee. He said, I saw in states' rights the only availing check upon the absolutism of the sovereign will, and secession filled me with hope, not as the destruction, but as the redemption of democracy. The institutions of your republic have not exercised on the old world the salutary and liberating influence which ought to have belonged to them by reason of those defects and abuses of principle which the Confederate Constitution was expressly and wisely calculated to remedy. I believe that the example of that great reform, the Confederate Constitution, would have blessed all the races of mankind by establishing true freedom purged of the native dangers and disorders of republics. Therefore, said Lord Acton, I deem that you were fighting the battles of our liberty, our progress, and our civilization, and I mourn for the stake which was lost at Richmond more deeply than I rejoice over that which was saved at Waterloo. And so here's Lord Acton. He's not defending slavery. He's saying that he recognized that the act of secession was the last real check, threat of secession, was the last real check on the will of the central government. And when they lost that, he's saying that this encouraged governments all over the world to do the same. He's saying this is not just an American issue. This was a demonstration to other governments in the world that they can monopolize political power through brute force and get away with it. And so, and they did. And that's, when we talk about when we get to the last class, that's one of the important consequences of the American Civil War, is that had the South been allowed to secede peacefully, and had slavery been ended peacefully like all the other countries of the world did in the 19th century, then it would have been a counterexample to all the centralization that occurred in Russia and Germany and elsewhere in Europe, where the whole world could have seen an alternative vision of government, because the late 19th century, early 20th century, really was a period of centralization and socialism and fascism, and America would have been an alternative to that. But instead, we moved in the same direction. General Lee responded. General Lee responded to Lord Acton, and this is a very telling thing. This is not the kind of statement that he would have made, invented, after the fact, off the top of his head. I think Lee had to always have believed in this, because he has sort of a deep understanding of the meaning of the defeat of the South in the war. And he said this on December 15, 1866. He wrote back and said, "While I have considered the preservation of the constitutional power of the general government, that is the U.S. government, to be the foundation of our peace and safety at home and abroad, I yet believe that the maintenance of the rights and authority reserved to the states and to the people," he's referring to the 10th Amendment here, "not only are essential to the adjustment and balance of the general system, but the safeguard to the continuance of a free government. I consider it as the chief source of stability in our political system, whereas the consolidation of the states into one vast political in one vast republic, sure to be aggressive abroad and despotic at home, will be the certain precursor of that ruin which has overwhelmed all those that have preceded it," end quote. And that was certainly a very prescient thing for Robert E. Lee to say. This was really the Jeffersonian philosophy of government. Jefferson always believed that the 10th Amendment was the cornerstone of the entire United States Constitution. And that's even the argument he made. The one thing that Jefferson is most criticized for is the Louisiana Purchase, because there was no delegated power in the Constitution for any such thing. But one of the things he said about that is he said he wanted America to be an empire of liberty, and he considered the 10th Amendment to the Constitution to be the cornerstone of the document that was hopefully would protect that liberty, and that he didn't think the Louisiana Purchase would have imposed any harm at all on the 10th Amendment. And so he thought the Louisiana Purchase would expand the domain of this empire of liberty, which under the Constitution, and that was his argument about this. And so that, it tells you how much he thought that the 10th Amendment was so important. It was the most important part of the whole document. And this is exactly what Robert E. Lee is saying, and it's exactly what Lord Acton is saying. He understood that as well. But of course, the war meant that really the death of states' rights or federalism, you could call it federalism too, is as far as that's concerned. And so, the big lie of Lincoln, as I call it, was used to justify his invasion of the states. And as I mentioned in the last class, or maybe in several of the classes, that, and I put on the quiz, that if you read the Constitution, Article 3, Section 3, it very clearly states that treason is defined only, it says only as levying war against the states or giving aid and comfort to their enemies. And that, of course, is exactly what Lincoln did. And so how did he justify this? This is how he justified it. He claimed that the states were never sovereign, that the Constitution was created by the whole people, not by the individual people of the individual states at political conventions, contrary to all history, and he got away with it. But don't give too much credit with giving away with a clever argument, because he used a lot of military force to prove himself right. And it's easy to prove yourself right when you have the ability to bomb your opponents into submission, and that's essentially what he did. And so I think I'll stop there with a lecture. It's been about 45 minutes or so. And I think between what I've said and the readings I put on there, I think you get a good idea of what the position is that Lincoln's basic argument or justification for invading his own country was based on what Donald Livingston calls a spectacular lie. And now I'm going to go through I only printed out one question before the class by Rob Mack that's related to this. I guess related to states' rights, federalism, and so forth. And I'll read this. Rob says that early last year, Obama signed an executive order establishing something called the Council of Governors, made up of 10 appointed regional governors, so supposedly coordinating the regional homeland security and defense activities of the U.S. And alarm bells were sounded by those who are worried about this as a threat to 10th Amendment sovereignty. And he wants me to comment on this. Well, yeah, this certainly is a threat to whatever might be left of 10th Amendment sovereignty. I mean, that's almost an oxymoron, the 10th Amendment sovereignty anymore, because the 10th Amendment has been so neutered, although some of the states are trying to revive it or resuscitate it. But yeah, this is just yet another example of the central government reaching out and controlling the states. Another example would be the increased militarization of the police, and the whole homeland security bureaucracy has been used in this way. So has the war on drugs. The war on drugs has been used to federalize local law enforcement. Under the original Constitution, the law enforcement is supposed to be a local prerogative, not the federal government. And so this is just, this is yet another example of the state using a crisis like this, or the imagined crisis, homeland security, fatherland security, I call it, because it sounds more Nazi-like, which is what it really is, to grab onto power, to take over more snooping to be in on the citizens of the states. In the front page of the Baltimore Sun just today, there was a big article about how Baltimore County, Maryland is putting in hundreds of more cameras to spy on everybody and to take pictures of your license plate if you're driving too fast, you know, over the speed limit and so forth. And a lot of that is funded by Homeland Security grants. And so they really are producing a police state in a big way by doing this. And so that's what I would have to say about that particular question. Let's see, Mark J. says, how has the 10th Amendment been neutered? Operating under the Constitution, how has it been neutered? The Constitution gives only 18 specific powers to the federal government given to it by the states. Article 1, Section 8, that's what it is. Those are the legitimate constitutional functions of the central government. And then the 10th Amendment says everything else is the prerogative of the citizens and the states, respectively. And so, you know, obviously the government has just ignored that. And the so-called system of checks and balances or the separation of powers has turned out to be a totally bogus idea, because what really happens is that the three branches of government collude and conspire with each other to always expand the size and scope and perks of government, of the central government. The Supreme Court did not rule a single federal law unconstitutional between 1937 and 1995, according to Judge Andrew Napolitano in his book, The Constitution in Exile. So what the Supreme Court has been doing for at least all that time has been almost exclusively just rubber stamping whatever the government and the other sections of government want to do, as long as it expands the size and scope of government, not if it restricts the size and scope of government. And so all three branches protect each other. For example, you could have a year from now, you could have maybe 10 or 12 states that have sued over Obamacare and have judges rule like the one in Florida did last week that the whole thing is unconstitutional. But I'm willing to bet a lot of money that when it goes to the Supreme Court, it will easily be ruled constitutional by the Supreme Court. Even the conservatives on the court will go along with it. They're not going to rule it unconstitutional. And so that's how the 10th Amendment has been neutered. But most importantly, the 10th Amendment reserves all other rights to the citizens in the states. That included the right of nullification and the right of secession, because they were sovereign. And so the Civil War ended that. That was the biggest blow to the 10th Amendment, the Civil War. And then the next to the biggest blow to the 10th Amendment was the year 1913, when the government adopted the Fed and the income tax and the 17th Amendment. All in the same year. The Fed and the income tax obviously gave the central government enormous financial power to rule over us. And the 17th Amendment altered the election of United States senators. They were appointed by legislatures until 1913. And then when the 17th Amendment came in, that meant that U.S. senators would run for election by a popular vote. And of course, what that means is that they can go raise money anywhere, in China even, to put television ads on and get themselves elected, and they no longer have to pay that much attention to the folks back home if they can raise enough money from China and Wall Street and California to pretty much monopolize their seat in the United States Senate and keep it detached from any serious competition because they have so much money. And so that was sort of some of the final nails in the coffin of the 10th Amendment. And then over the years, Supreme Court decisions of all sorts have neutered the 10th Amendment also, and have given the federal government more and more power to do. So that's how we got to where we are today. The federal government is pretty much one giant monopoly. Let's see, there's a web article there. Peter wants to know what would be the effect of secession today. I'm not sure about that. Hans Hermann Hoppe thinks that the most effective way for it to work would be for cities to secede. He thinks the government wouldn't have the nerve to try to conquer and occupy an individual city, whereas an entire state is a different matter. And so I'm not sure if he's right or not, who knows. But you know, if you would ask that to somebody in the Soviet Union in 1987, they probably would have said, you know, fat chance. But that, of course, is exactly how the Soviet Union imploded, with all these separate acts of peaceful secession. And so, but they were lucky. They had a Gorbachev. They had the head of the Communist Party as head of their government. They did not have Abe Lincoln. If they had Abe Lincoln, they would have been in big, big trouble in the former Soviet Union. So we'll go backwards here. See, Tom Mullen wrote an article about using interposition to shield the people from the feds. States should say their citizens won't send tax money. Well, interposition was just another word for nullification. It's really basically the same idea. Actually, interposition is the better word, but somehow nullification has been used. But it's the citizens of the states themselves interposing, you know, and saying to the federal government, wait a minute, this is not constitutional in our opinion, and we do not intend to do this, to comply with this. Whether it's the sedition law during Thomas Jefferson's time or the Fugitive Slave Act in the northern states, interposition is what was happening, although the word nullification is being used. So Tim asks, do I believe it's correct to say the Bill of Rights grants no prohibitions to the states? The Constitution governs the federal government. That was the original idea, but then the courts have changed it. The courts have reinterpreted it. They call it the Incorporation Doctrine. For example, John Marshall, the Chief Justice in the early 1800s, he just invented out of thin air the idea that the federal judiciary had the right to comment on state judicial proceedings. That was nowhere in the Constitution. Marshall just made that up and proceeded to do it. And other courts have done it as well. And so they just grabbed power because they could. And no one had the nerve to oppose them. I wish they did. I don't know how many federalized police are in existence, but I want to give an idea of the enormous influence of the whole. So you can find the book and you can see my review of it there. Let's see, I'll go back up here to where it was. Let's see, Mike says, I started off saying that Hamilton lobbied for 7 years for the convention. To modify the articles. He read that it was Madison writing a letter to Washington. And his ride to Western Pennsylvania confuses me. So, let's see. Was Washington a Federalist? Well, Hamilton wasn't the only one who wanted a constitutional convention, of course. Madison and John Jay co-authored the Federalist Papers, which were the sort of really the nationalist case for the Constitution. And so I didn't say that Hamilton was the only person, but I think he was the most forceful proponent of revising the Articles. And of course, the Articles of Confederation, the official title, is the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, and they dropped the words Perpetual Union. Those words exist nowhere in the U.S. Constitution. And that's another sort of an important point about this business of the perpetual constitution that, that Lincoln claims existed. Let's see. Now, I write about the, Mike is referring to the Whiskey Rebellion here. The Whiskey Rebellion, and where Hamilton worked with members of Congress to get a special tax on whiskey imposed during when he was Secretary of the Treasury under George Washington. He also got a national property tax put in place. That caused a tax protest in New England, and the whiskey tax caused a tax protest in western Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh, because farmers, wheat farmers, grain farmers, had figured out that it was more economical, more profitable to turn their grain into liquor, the alcohol, and then sell the alcohol than to ship the big bulky grain across the state of Pennsylvania to Philadelphia and elsewhere to sell it. And so they saw a special tax on whiskey as highly discriminatory. And they, you know, they made the argument, well, why no special tax on tobacco or rice or cotton or anything else? Why the whiskey tax? And they were right about that. And so they taxed, they protested, they tarred and feathered tax collectors and so forth. And Hamilton wanted to show that the government was willing to use deadly force to collect taxes. And so he got George Washington to go along with conscripting 15,000 men from the Eastern Seaboard, led by other officers who were bondholders, government bondholders. And the whole idea here was, and I write about the whole story in my book, Hamilton's Curse. Hamilton wanted to grow government to be much bigger than it already was. That's why he's called the public debt a public blessing. Why did he call the public debt a public blessing? He said that the bondholders would be mostly the wealthier people of the country. And so they were the ones who were going to own the public debt. They were the ones that had the money to buy the government bonds. And so if Hamilton argued, if we can tie these people to the government, then they will always become very powerful and forceful lobbyists for what we want, that is bigger and more activist government, because they will always want to have higher taxes to make sure there's enough money in the treasury to pay off their bonds. And so when he led the whiskey the attack on the whiskey rebels, and he led 15,000 men up to Pennsylvania, the officers were these bondholders. They were not conscripted, but the soldiers were conscripted. They were draftees by the states, some of the states. And they rode into western Pennsylvania, rounded up a couple of dozen of the major tax protesters, the organizers, made them walk all the way across the state of Pennsylvania in the snow to Philadelphia, some of whom did not have shoes, and then they put them on trial with Hamilton himself being the sole judge and in his view, would-be executioner. Hamilton wanted to hang all of them, but George Washington pardoned all of them. George Washington went home in the middle of it, didn't even stay. And so Hamilton failed. Despite all this show of 15,000 soldiers rounding up the tax protesters, putting them on trial, Washington pardoned all of them and they ended up not paying the whiskey tax after all. And that was one of the things that led to the destruction of the Federalist Party, this sort of heavy-handed tyranny over tax collection. And that whole episode is what convinced me is that that's the reason why Hamilton wanted a standing army, but Jefferson did not. He wanted a standing army of tax collectors who would intimidate Americans into complying with the government's taxes and the government's regulations and edicts, because that's what the European monarchs had done. It wasn't a standing army for national defense purposes. It was a standing army that would intimidate Americans, not the British or the French or anywhere else. And that's exactly what he used his army in the Whiskey Rebellion to do. And that's what it proved to me. But then, of course, Jefferson was elected a couple of years later, elected president, and he had succeeded in getting Congress to abolish the whiskey tax and all the other excise taxes. And George Washington, I don't know why he went along with it. He was probably weak and tired and old by then, and he gave people like Hamilton too much rein. too much power. Let's see if I get another question in here. Let's see, where are we? Rob wants to know if I find that people are becoming more informed of U.S. history. I think since the advent of the internet has been a good thing. I have no way of knowing if people in general are becoming more educated about history, but it's a different world today where people like Tom Woods and I can write articles on the web. We can respond to critics on the web, and we get thousands of people to read our articles. We can publish books with commercial presses that don't have to go through the gatekeepers of academe, who are overwhelmingly statists. And so it's a different world today, mostly because of the internet, and the publishing business is very different today because it's so cheap to publish things compared to 30 years ago that it was almost the stone tablet era in terms of technology and publishing 30 years ago. But it's very different today. And so I know we're making progress with a lot of people, but I have no way of knowing if it's what the percentage of people is or anything like that. What was the British government's general stance on the Civil War? Well, the British government, there's a book called The Glittering Illusion by Sheldon Van Auken, V-A-N-A-U-K-E-N. And he surveyed during his time, I think he wrote this in the 60s, quite an old book. He surveyed the opinions of British opinion makers, and the illusion, the glittering illusion was that their thought was that Robert E. Lee was such a superior general to all the other Union generals that they thought that the South would win and that they would not need the British support. But there was a lot of support. As I wrote, Lord Acton, who was an advisor to the Prime Minister of England at the time, was a supporter of the southern side of the war. There were intellectuals. There was a debate between John Stuart Mill and Charles Dickens. Charles Dickens was on the side of the South. John Stuart Mill was on the side of the North during the war, for example. But the British government was neutral, officially neutral, and Van Auken makes the case that the reason they were neutral is that they never thought that these gang of political appointees in general's uniforms in the northern states would win the war, but they probably underestimated the economic might of the northern states compared to the southern states that allowed them to overwhelm, and the population imbalance. And they conscripted hundreds of thousands of men and also a couple hundred thousand European mercenaries that they paid to fight on their side, and so the British probably underestimated that. Charles Adams also wrote a book. He didn't write it. It's a collection of essays by Europeans in Switzerland, England, France, Greece, of all sorts of opinion of Europeans about the war. So if you're really interested in that topic, those are two books I would look at. Being not looked into this Hamiltonian property tax. The Constitution says that the taxes should be uniform, and that certainly wasn't. There was a rebellion in New England over this national property tax. It's one of the reasons why the Federalist Party imploded, in my view. Let's see, I said the Electoral College was a part of states' rights. I don't think I said that, but it's true. Could I explain about this? Well, the Electoral College, I think the idea behind the Electoral College is, again, you know, the people of the states elect the electors. And so not the state legislature, but the people of the states, and the states all have different rules for how they go about doing this and getting their electors in. So once again, it's not centralized, it's not top down, it's the citizens of the states, the electoral college. And one of the reasons we have this is that, you know, if we just had a popular vote, then the most populous states would always win. California and New York would determine every election. So all the leftists in California and all the leftists in New York would totally monopolize politics if we just had majority vote popular elections, which we don't. We have the Electoral College, which elects, you get electors by each state. And I think that was the idea. They didn't want mass democracy to determine things, because then states like Rhode Island and, you know, would be abused by the bigger, more populous states in the future. Let's see. Tim wants to know if it took a lot of guts to write the real Lincoln. No, I've been throwing rocks at the state my entire career for 20 some years before I wrote the real Lincoln. And so it didn't take a special guts, I don't think. Although I knew that I was going to kick over a hornet's nest. And also, why is this Thomas Cranawitter teaching at Hillsdale? Well, the president of Hillsdale is the former executive director of the Claremont Institute, which is sort of the Lincoln Cult Central, and Cranawitter got his degree. He wrote his dissertation under the high priest of the Claremont Institute Lincoln Cult, Harry Jaffa, at the Claremont Graduate School. That's why he works at Hillsdale. He was hired in a non-competitive position by Larry Arnn, the president of Hillsdale, and so that's why he works there. They're turning Hillsdale into a foreign policy interventionism academy, by the way. Let's see, what else we got here? Great to liberate Hillsdale, yeah. Yeah, who knows? Let's see what else I can find here. See, I'm way back up here. Linda, where was that? I lost her. Where's Linda? Uh-oh. Sorry about the delay. I'm trying to look for a new question here. Well, I had one from Linda, but I guess I can't find it. Well, I'll go back to the bottom then. Let's see. If the original powers of the Supreme Court were not expanded by John Marshall, though, I think state courts would be the primary arbiters of legal issues. Well, the state courts would certainly be not as controlled by the federal judiciary as they are now. I mean, I have ever been, ever since Marshall intervened as he did. And I write about this in my book, Hamilton's Curse. I have one of the chapters is entitled Hamilton's Disciple, How John Marshall Subverted the Constitution. So I tell a good bit of the story about Marshall there. And in fact, there's this book I think I might have mentioned. It's called Recarving Rushmore by Ivan Eland. He ranks the presidents according to how good a job they did protecting life, liberty, and property of the American citizens. And he gives John Adams a very low ranking for two reasons, the Sedition Act, and he appointed John Marshall to the Supreme Court. And so that's how bad Marshall was. If not everything he did was bad, he made some decisions that protected property rights, for example. But in general, he was a Hamiltonian and power mad as a judge. tax movement arguments Mike is asking about. Well, there are a lot of tax protesters out there. I think somebody mentioned Peter Schiff's father. Yeah, Peter Schiff's father spent his whole life writing books saying you don't have to pay the income tax, and then he wouldn't pay the income tax. He'd go to jail. He'd write another book while he was in jail, get out of jail, go back to jail again because he didn't pay income tax, and kept proving himself wrong his whole life. I always get I get emails all the time from people who know the legal argument. They tell me you don't have to pay the income tax. It was never fully constitutionally ratified in the right way. But my response is that the government has enough guns with which to enforce the income tax. Therefore, it will enforce the income tax. It doesn't really matter what procedure was used back when the 16th Amendment was passed. They have the guns with which to enforce it, and they will enforce it. Let's see, what's Jefferson's Kentucky Resolve of 1798? When the Federalists gained power, these were the New Englanders for the most part, John Adams as president. First thing they did was to outlaw free speech in America with the Sedition Act under the guise of being worried about an invasion from France. And so they outlawed free speech. You couldn't criticize the Adams or his administration. And really the genesis of it, yet another one of my articles on lourockwell.com is entitled, I think it's entitled The Origins of Nullification, which I wrote a couple of months ago. And it's an interesting story if you look up the history books on this. John Adams was really an imperious king. He thought himself as a king. Whenever he and Abigail Adams, his wife, would go back home to New England, they would have an entourage of stagecoaches in a parade all up and down the East Coast. They would stop at each city, and the cannons would be blaring and the trumpets sounding. And so of course, he received a lot of really harsh criticism for this. And he and his wife deeply resented the criticism. And so they passed the Sedition Act, which made it a crime to criticize him. And so they did. And so Jefferson was asked by his friend John C. Breckinridge of Kentucky, who was a senator, to write the Kentucky Resolve for the state of Kentucky. We didn't know this until several decades later, when the document in Jefferson's own handwriting appeared that proved that Jefferson was in fact the author of the Kentucky Resolve, but he kept it a secret. And it essentially said that it's a great statement of the compact theory of the state, of the American state, that is a compact among the states, and that the states are not going to submit to the unlimited power of the central government. They reserve the rights to themselves to decide on constitutional issues, as well as listening to what the Supreme Court says. And they said we essentially are not going to enforce the Sedition Act in the state of Kentucky. And James Madison wrote an almost identical document called the Virginia Resolve of 1798. And so that's where that comes from. And then, of course, other states use this idea of nullification to nullify all sorts of things, tariffs, the Bank of the United States, the Fugitive Slave Act, and so forth, North and South. Everyone used it to object to what they thought were unconstitutional laws, or a tariff of 1828 was nullified by South Carolina, for example. I don't know if the 17th Amendment could be repealed. It'd be great if it was, because the original idea of the founders was politicians, senators, would be less likely to sell out at the expense of the folks back home to lobbyists if they could be fired on the spot by the folks back home's representatives in the state legislature. And that did happen. There were, I think the number was 7 senators who went to Washington, D.C. in the early 1830s, promising the folks back home that they would support Andrew Jackson in his battle against the first central bank, the Bank of the United States. They got to Washington and they changed their mind. They became critics of Jackson, and all 7 of them were summarily fired by their state legislatures. That's how it was supposed to work. And so that would be a great benefit if we could bring that back. Several states nullified the U.S. Bank. A good book on that would be Andrew Jackson and the Bank Wars by Robert Remini, R-E-M-I-N-I. He tells does a pretty good job of telling the whole story of the Bank Wars. Another source is the book I mentioned earlier, James J. Kilpatrick, The Sovereign States. He also does an excellent job of explaining Andrew Jackson and the Bank Wars. But Remini's book is a small little paperback. And it tells you, it's a good read for, about on that issue. And so the state of Ohio, for example, imposed a tax of $50,000 per branch on the Bank of the United States in the two branches in the state of Ohio. And it actually sent armed marshals into the bank to take, and it took $100,000 out of the vaults at gunpoint when the Bank of the United States refused to pay the fines. And so that was a real confrontation over the Bank of the United States with the state of Ohio. Let's see. See, McBean is arguing over whether the judicial review by the Supreme Court was intended to be implied by the wordings of Article 3. I don't think anything was intended to be implied. The founders wrote what they wrote. Once you go down the road of saying there are implied powers, then there are unlimited powers. Then. And the politicians and government lawyers with lifetime tenure will make anything up that will expand their powers and their pay. And so Article 3 says what it says. It doesn't say what some politician of the day thinks they really was implied by it. And so judicial review was not a part of the Constitution. It was invented by John Marshall himself in order to give himself more power. McCulloch versus Maryland was the case on the Bank of the United States. This is where John Marshall said the power to tax is the power to destroy. He was referring to those taxes that states like Ohio and Maryland had imposed on branches of the Bank of the United States. And of course, he was right. That was their intent, was to destroy the Bank of the United States. And so in McCulloch versus Maryland, he ruled that the Bank of the United States is constitutional, in his opinion, even though the Constitutional Convention debated a national bank and rejected the idea. John Marshall made up this notion that it's constitutional. But Andrew Jackson responded by essentially saying, thanks for your opinion, but my opinion is different, and my opinion is just as important as yours, Mr. Marshall. This was before we adopted this idea that the Supreme Court is supreme in constitutional interpretation. That occurred after the Civil War. That was not true before the Civil War, but after the Civil War, the federal government monopolized constitutional interpretation through the Supreme Court. And I think I read to you the statement earlier tonight by John Taylor warning about that. And the Jeffersonians always knew that would be the road to despotism if the government, through its own courts, ever became the sole arbiter of what is and is not constitutional. And they were certainly right about that. And that was McCulloch versus Maryland was the name of that case. Let's see. Let's see if I can find that thing from Linda that I started to read and then I lost it. No, maybe not. Well, here it is. Of the states that did secede, isn't it true that Virginia had a defensible argument since they had, in ratifying the Constitution, included the opt-out language? Virginia, Rhode Island, and New York did use that language, but that language applied to all the states once they were accepted into the Union. And all the states assumed that the government was consensual, voluntary. Now, the Union was voluntary. You could opt in or opt out. There was no talk about bombing Boston when the New England Federalists spent 12 years debating and talking about and threatening secession. There was no talk of bombing North Carolina and Rhode Island and murdering hundreds of thousands of people when they remained out of the Union for years after the Constitution already became the law of the land when 9 states ratified it. That was a new doctrine of force invented by Abe Lincoln, that he had the right to invade his own country in the name of this union. This idea of the sanctity of the perpetual union is a foreign idea to the American founders. The union was just a practical political agreement. But go ahead and read Abe Lincoln's Thanksgiving proclamation that's online, where he has declared the first Thanksgiving holiday. Near the very end, he says that the union is divine. He used the word divine. He says it's not just a practical political arrangement, which is how the founders thought of it. He said it was actually created by God. And this is from a man who was probably an atheist. Lincoln never became a Christian. He never joined a church, rarely stepped foot in a church. He wrote a whole book criticizing scripture as a young man. Both his wife and his law partner, William Herndon, said he never became a Christian. And yet he would use biblical language like this to sort of dupe the public into believing in what he's trying to do. Okay, Mike wants me to go to sleep so that I can go and trash the Fed tomorrow morning. Okay, I guess that's a plea to quit cease and desist, I guess. It's 8:52. I guess we've been at it a while, and these things are slow. Questions are slowing down. Okay, so we'll end it there, and I think Danny has these scores of the quizzes for you, or he will very shortly. So we'll have fun tomorrow. I have the testimony of the Keynesian, who's going to be there on the witness stand, and I'm hoping they'll ask me about his testimony too, because it's all very silly, but we'll have fun, and have a good night, and I enjoyed the class.